Did it have any effect beyond that in terms of ethics legislation?
Yeah, I think it made things easier to pass. I think that the lobby...
Did it make lobbying, did it reduce the effect of lobbyists?
I don't think there's any question that, you know, Daniel proved that the legislature could exist without the lobby. First time ever.
The lobby refers to what? We've heard that term. Reference to the lobby as a collective, almost.
Well, it is, and, you know, you, if you really look at it, again, you get into personalities, but the railroads represented by Walter Cabin, the chemical council represented by Harry Whitworth, the lobbyist for the Texas Manufacturers Association, Yancey out of Houston, Jill Devote with the shale dredging industry, which is unique but extremely strong, then each official representing the majors in oil, the people that represent the Texas independent producers, the home builders represented by John Terrell, beer distributors represented by Dick Corey. These people are all players in terms of their total impact and effect, and virtually for years controlled. And you had speakers up until the Barnes-Mutcher era who literally they were referred to as the third house. You know, Gus Mutcher, when you talk to him about a problem, income problem, he'd say, well, I wonder what the third house would think about this. I mean, it was a factor in his decision making. But Gus was the first guy that was really totally enamored of him and, you know, that kind of thing. Barnes, at least, through Connolly's tutelage and otherwise, knew when to sit down on him. You know, he was still in control, much of what they controlled him. But I think that pretty well went out the window with the Daniel administration. It's going to be very fascinating to see what it will do with Clayton. But I rather imagine that Clayton is a smart man, and he will understand that, you know, for a long time the lobby traded on the term conservative because conservative was used as synonymous with business interests. And so they'd say, you know, he cast a good conservative vote, and we'll tell your constituents. Well, most constituents felt themselves to be conservative, but they traded on this, that you know, if you were conservative, you were pro-business and anti-labor. But it also resulted in, you know, tremendous interest rate legislation and that kind of thing.
And also but, connoted sort of against social legislation.
Basically, because it costs money. And they're usually, you know, among other things, always looking over their shoulder to see where the next corporate profits tax might crop up.
When the term majors are used in Texas, specifically, you're referring to which oil companies?
Well, the same ones that you see when you drive down the highway. Exxon, Texaco, Mobil, Arco. And they are represented by another player who's Texas Mid-Continent Oil and Gas Producers Association. His name is Bill Abington. These are the people who live in Dallas, pick up everything, come down here and live in Austin from January until whenever the adjournment takes place. Others stay here all the time. The shale lobbyist lives in Austin.
You were saying that you thought you might end up actually have more institutional power than the governor.
In terms of freedom from restraint, I have a very broad mandate to manage the public lands of the state, and particularly in areas that I'm interested in, environmental protection and also income production. I can do what needs to be done by deciding that it needs to be done. He is sitting over there with a budgetary speech to the legislature, but, you know, maybe broad outlines. But other than his appointed capability, there's very little that the governor of Texas can do.
The lieutenant governor and speaker both traditionally have been strongly independent of the governor. Is that correct?
That's normally been true, and it's also been because of competitive feeling and about who's going to run against the governor next. But also, those people have more power than he has in many instances. just the simple capability of naming committee chairman and appointing committees is probably stronger than virtually any other power the governor has. Plus being able to then control the calendar committee or, you know, what really gets up. That makes it pretty stout.
How would you characterize the state of the Republican Party in Texas at this time?
Just really in serious trouble.
Why?
Oh, John Tower has religiously failed to let anybody up to run for anything else because of the possible drain on his finances. An amazing parallel to the way Arbor was when he was senator. Hard to get young people interested. All of the attendant problems from Watergate. A massive loss, no real candidate potential, no, you know, they're just in a terrible box, then just all the tradition. They don't know whether to run, you know, six people in the statewide situation or whether to single shot one. And then if they single shot one, it's usually governor. So the Democrats put all their money into that one and everybody joins forces. And, you know, and I'm convinced that most election is in this state has been a stepping stone or building block process. Well, they don't have any stones to step from. Then they see themselves as loyal opposition in the House, and they get in trouble, you know, because of some of their individuals. And so they've just got a whole bunch of problems. Plus the fact that, you know, what's the difference between a moderate Republican and a moderate Democrat or a conservative Democrat and a conservative Republican? You know, there's not that much philosophical choice between a Republican and a Democrat. It's just a name.
And the Republicans that have been in the legislature, they played any sort of watchdog role?
No. Most of them have just stirred up trouble. I don't know of, you know, anyone who thinks that, you know, where they've made any progress at all, it's been with guys like Bush at the congressional level.
Guys like who?
Bush. George. And I just, you know, if I were a Republican, you know, look at the Connally situation. You know, it just seems like everything they've had happen to them has been bad. Everybody thought there'd be this great exodus the minute Connally or somebody like him really made the move.
And nothing happened.
Well, not only did nothing happen, but then look what happens to Connally.
Right.
You know, it's just double bad. There again, it's personality oriented. And it's a timing thing. You know, look at my situation. I gambled, but you know, I had a Republican who was aggressive in the early stages. Really didn't have too much to talk about, and I had answers for the criticism. But when you can win big with $7,000, you know, and I'm not being naive about the fact that I was incumbent and that I'd done a lot ahead of time before then, but still the showing that, you know, 20, you know, you can almost get 40% of the vote nearly any time, and they get 25 or 26%. So they just have some real major problems. National politics, it may be different, but, you know, we're not afraid as a state to vote for Republicans, and Tower wins. Tower spent six times what his opponent spent. His opponent was not as able as he could have been, and he was relatively new. And you give a guy $2.4 million, which is the most anybody's ever spent, United States Senate rates, ever. And and he can prevail with the incumbency behind him, but I still think he's beatable.
Why?
Because he's never had an opponent with stature. All of his opponents have had real, you know, Wagner Carr was one, Bill Blakely was one. The only way the Republicans have ever prevailed is when a Democrat tries to out-conservative them, and therefore the liberals take a walk or vote Republican. And somebody with credentials and a track record and that kind of thing, I think, you know, most people are pretty turned off about Tower. Republicans, you know, in terms of stature, certainly.
Hello? Democratic candidate for president.
Well, I've always felt that McGovern's biggest problem was his own incapability to advocate. It's certainly a traditionally Democratic state. But, you know, I was very frustrated, had some long talks with Mankiewicz about this, and he never had the capability of a lawyer to lay a predicate before he made a suggestion. You know, if he had said, given the present state of inequity and inefficiency of welfare, how bungling it is, given the basic inequities in terms of our tax structure, we'd be better off giving everybody $1,000 than we would under the present situation. That would have had, to me, much more of a chance of acceptance in this state or anywhere than just saying, I suggest that we give everybody $1,000. You know, that all of a sudden, you know, but you have to lay the predicate. The key to that argument is the predicate. If he had said, as Mankiewicz believed, the problem with the depletion allowance is it's based, among other things, on a hope that people will take the money as a result of the depletion allowance and invest it in oil. If somebody had said, you know, the depletion allowance is unrealistic, it's based on, okay, argue with me that the depletion allowance is because there is a depleted resource and you ought to get a tax break when you're depleting your resource to furnish something to somebody else. That's fine. The problem with the depletion allowance is it's 5 years at 20, you know, it's 4 years at 25%. It's less than 4 years. Well, hell, we got wells that have been pumping for 20. Why not come up with an equitable analysis of the productive capability of that well and base your depletion allowance on the depleting characteristics? If it's a 10-year well, 10%. If it's a 15-year well, you know, 8.5 or whatever that figures out to be, 7.5. If it's a 5-year well, 20%. You know, then you're talking about something equitable. But, you know, that was kind of what was in his thinking, but he just said, we've got to end the depletion allowance. This is what worries me about the present congressional idea, that you just end it. There's some inequity there because it is a depletable resource. But this idea, you know, but he never had a grasp. So what I'm saying is he was a poor candidate. If it's a Democratic candidate that makes sense, they're going to vote for him. It's there, you know, traditionally. And
you're saying it's not so much whether it's a Democratic candidate who's a conservative or a liberal is one
who he is.
Who can?
I think a liberal could win in Texas with a good advocacy.
Who can explain his programs,
sure,
in effect.
And has something to say. Same thing Broder says, problem with the party. Who stands for anything that's running for president in the Democratic camp right now? And what do they stand for? You know, where's the fair deal? Where's the new deal? Where's the new society? Where's anything? You know, put Benson on there and talk about economy, and he doesn't say anything substantially different from what Nixon's saying. Maybe a little, but
is this candidacy viewed seriously in this state?
It's viewed seriously in Houston because he's one of their own. It's viewed seriously basically because, okay, he's all right. He's one of ours. You know, got all that going for him. But the main reason it's viewed seriously is because there are no alternatives that are very viable. And as long as there isn't anybody with any more capability showing up, You know, Moe's not doing that well. Mondale chucks it. I heard a fascinating interview, I don't know whether you heard it the other day. It was really penetrating. Captain Cloakroom or Meet the Press, somebody did Birch Bayh. And Bayh was really better than I've ever heard him. He talked about a lot of real unusual things, talked about what the campaigning for the presidency does to you as a person and to your family, and why maybe you've got a new breed of guys like the Mondales and the Kennedys who can really say, I don't care whether I'm president or not, but it's not worth it. And then he says, on the other hand, maybe you got to have a guy that thinks it's worth it before he'll do it. But here are all your young people that would normally be associated with a bunch of young candidates, and I find myself in the same situation. We've all got kids, and we all care about what we're doing to them. Now, Lyndon Johnson probably didn't care what he did to his kids, you know, because it was more important to him to be wherever he was. Maybe the kids would take care of themselves, but most young people don't feel that way anymore. And so you have a bunch of non-runners all of a sudden because of their commitment to their family or their commitment to something else, themselves maybe. So then you find a guy like Benson, he may be a more viable candidate because his kids are all out of school and grown, and, you know, than maybe a guy like Bayh or Kennedy. It was a very interesting interview. I didn't feel like he was pulling any punches or, you know, he was saying some things that were just, you know, heretical if you'd said them 5 years ago. I thought that was very fascinating. And I felt very strongly parallel to him in some of my decision making, which is eventually going to have to be made in terms of, you know, how selfish it is or how much it needs doing, as opposed to, you know, the loss of anonymity.
There ain't no going back.
Yeah,
once you make the commitment.
And the other thing, look at, you know, the one thing I consider very strongly is what I call owning yourself, anonymity loss. You know, little things. You can't take off and go sit down at a public place and get plowed and having a good time with people because everybody said, look, there's the governor, there's the senator down there getting drunk. You know, if land commissioner does that, they think, God, he's really real. But, you know, there's just that funny little thing between the lower echelon and that U.S. Senate governor thing. And, you know, the worst thing you could probably do to yourself is win. You might survive if you lose it. You know, then you were just the candidate for governor back there. But then once you got there, it's pretty tough, the strains that it puts on you. So back sort of to the thread of the question, I think that a guy like Benson is there because there is no alternative that has any better chance right now. I mean, you know, he can make a pretty good case. He's got a bunch of handouts now from some pretty strong people, Evans and Novak and others writing, making a case for him, that he has put aside the basic Texas draw. He's put aside the Lyndon Johnson image, much more like Conlon, suave, sophisticated. But he's also obviously with an effort, you know, and so he doesn't come across totally real, as though he's playing a part. But he's been making the right speeches to the right people. Mankiewicz is for him to a degree, which is unusual. Hmm. But Frank thinks that the liberals have had their heads battered down sufficiently as a result of that. If some progressive person will come out of the South, Benson, Askew, Carter, Bumpers, that the liberals will buy him. And, you know, they want to win.
They don't see then that Benson and the defeat of Yarborough being held against him by the liberals.
Will be held against him by some. And the problem I had, my liberal friends and my liberal constituency would be appalled if I came out four square strong for Benson. I don't think about that much, I mean, but I, they would be. Don't you remember what he did to Ralph? And you know, Ralph's really got his stinger out. He spent 3 days in town before the Democratic Convention, labor meetings, all kinds of liberal meetings and everything else, just being sure that they remember how much Lloyd spent against him, beat him, and take that seat away from him. It's very personal, very poor performance, but he did it. Consequently, when Benson walked on the stage, it was to just a resounding bunch of boos.
Now, by Dominion Convention?
No, no, State Convention.
Oh, State Convention here.
But you could attribute 80% of those boos to one man, and that was Ralph Yarborough, what he'd been doing for 2 or 3 days. You know, but that's, again, personalities and bad stuff, really. What you do about that.
Is the Democratic Party itself strong in Texas? Is there a strong party organization as such?
No, because we don't have a Republican opposition. It could be in a minute. If you ever had any Republicans really get with it, then you could do it. That's why, you know, all my liberal friends fuss and argue, want me to run for chairman this time. To organize the party, they say, man, you know, we go into Wisconsin, we go into places in Illinois and like that. There's an organization, there are cards, everybody knows who the Democrats are, they do all this. The reason is that in those states where you have that organization, you've got a very viable Republican opposition, and you have to be. Now, it's still strong, but it's strong because of, I guess, its name. And it's pretty balanced. I mean, you know, look at who won. And
but basically, do all the statewide office holders have their own organizations, their own personal organizations?
Oh, yeah.
They overlap, of course, but essentially you've got a whole series of organizations.
And, you know, John White's got a theory that his and my organizations are the only two there are. I don't know whether he's right or not. He thinks that, again, that the newcomers, the Hills, the Hobbies, the Briscoes, they all have a television electing capacity because they had the money to buy it at a time when you could win it with that. But the real test is what kind of organization they will then be able to put together in the same traditional sense we had. See, I won my first race with $104,000, which was pretty unheard of. But I had people in every county, and I had good people that I knew. But I had worked for Kennedy and Johnson in 3 congressional districts in 60. I had run Tom Reevely's unsuccessful campaign as his manager for Attorney General against Wagner Carr. I had been on the road with Will Wilson when he ran for Johnson's unexpired Senate seat when I was with the Attorney General's office. I was an administrative assistant running all the office work at the same time we were campaigning, and I introduced him. And, you know, I'd get people after people would say, off in a corner after it's over, well, you know, if he could speak like you, well, he'd win, but why don't you run for something? But, you know, I was traveling the state literally for 10 years. When I went to Lubbock, I didn't have to ask anybody who to see in Lubbock. I'd been calling on telephone for various candidates. All my candidates didn't win, but all the people I talked to were my friends. And I was co-chairing John Hill's race when Hill ran for governor. And so when I ran, I had pretty much been working in the vineyard for 10 years, talking to the people that made things go. And, you know, I didn't have a big card file. I've since computerized it, and I've got the only computerized political file in the state that has less than 25 names in it. But it sure does look pretty. So, but all 25 of them are super people. No, but it's relatively small. And But the thing that happened was, you know, everybody said it'd be great for a guy to come out of nowhere and win. Hell, it took 10 years to win that race, you know, basically, from 60 to 70. Plus, whatever exposure I had in the house that was broader than my own thing. I did a bunch of television that beat the sales tax on food. And it was financed by AFL-CIO, but they needed one advocate who could really carry the ball and do it. And I was that advocate. So you know, a lot of people said, again, lining up with the AFL-CIO, who's killed him. But it didn't work out that way. First of all, we shot down the food tax and beat Mutcher. And in effect, beat Barnes. Not a lot of people realize this, but I think that had a pretty strong effect on Barnes' losing his race. Because the food tax came out of the Senate when he was presiding over the Senate. Now, he dodged around and said, well, I just let the Senate do what I'm doing. But it had pretty strong carryover. And people, it became a strong public issue. But, you know, all those things happen over a long period of time. And with all that work, and I worked for a year and flew, you know, I keep hearing Ford say he's traveled over 20,000 miles campaigning for various people. I flew 350,000 miles and never got outside the state in that campaign. And, you know, it took a lot of time. The other guy that's done it somewhat similar is Bullock. Bullock has got in that car and drove this state for a full year and finally won. But it's going to be very interesting to see how all this shakes out in 4 years in terms of relative strengths.
You made some observation then that, we'll see, that suggested you believe that you can't do it with television anymore.
No, you can. It's an advantage. But I'm just saying that just doing it that way gave Hobby and Hill and Briscoe maybe a false sense of organizational strength, because basically those races were won by repetition to the public of, here is an honest person who wasn't involved in Sharpstown. But the reason he could get that word to the public was because he could pull $600,000 out of his own pocket. He'd win it either way. You win it with that if you get that, or you win it with organization without that. But if you had both, it would be ideal. But there is no democratic structure as such, because all of our races are run in primaries, and that's why the organizations then become individual organizations, because that's where you're competing.
Is there any running as a team in November after
yeah.
the primary? Do candidates generally run as a team?
Yeah, and
appear together and this sort of thing?
Appear together, and we got together and took a poll together to see how we were.
Any joint advertising together?
No. But we all, you know, get asked to contribute to the Harris County Get Out the Democratic Vote Drive, where they say, you know, vote Democrat. I did 3 or 4 spots and went out statewide saying, you know, vote Democratic. But, and why?
How does money work with blacks in elections in Texas?
Not as much as it used to. You know, it used to be that the most insidious anti-black candidate could buy black votes. That can't happen anymore. They have a good screening process. There again, they've been much more successful than the Chicanos in this endeavor.
Is there a new grassroots leadership among blacks coming out of the labor movement in Texas?
Some. Plus some pretty aggressive black legislators. Anthony Hall.
Elected black officials.
Craig Washington.
Where is he from?
Craig is Dallas. No, I believe they're both from Houston. Anthony's from Houston. And, you know, it's, I don't know, but I've got the legislative book right here in the conversation, but they can keep the pressure on.
Is
and
it true?
Craig particularly is effective because he's very articulate. He get good press anytime he walks the microphone. He's a beautiful speaker and really knows what he's talking about. He's a sharp guy. Leland's the same way. But Leland is funny, redheaded afro, costumed, tough as he can be.
Is it true that it was the black legislative caucus that basically was responsible for the defeat of the Constitution?
I don't know. when it misses by two votes, you can assign all kinds of reasons why it was defeated.
End interview with Bob Armstrong. No more transcription. This tape.